it. You'll be in good shape.
Okay, sweet. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
This is awkward. So I'd like to start by telling you about my home group. My home group is the Last Chance Group in Casper, Wyoming. We meet on Fridays and Saturday nights at 10 p.m., and we just recently are going to start a new meeting the third Tuesday of the month at the hospital. So we're pretty stoked about that. And so,
yay.
Okay. That is definitely something to cheer about. So I'd like to qualify myself. So I'd like to introduce myself as a full-fledged member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so what does that mean? And so I'm going to start by telling you about why I came here and why I deserve to be here. So the first time that I ever took a drink, just a drink, not like a full glass, just a drink of alcohol, I was about 13 years old. And I was at my friend's house. Her mom was gone. And we used to like to go over there because her mom was always gone. And she had a big bottle of vodka on top of the fridge. And she said, "We got to try this. You should drink it. It's really warm. Like, it burns when you swallow it." And I was like, "Okay, that sounds pretty scary. I'm not a big fan." And so I did. And something spiritual happened, right? Like, I took that first sip and I was like, "Okay, this is it. Like, this is what I need to do." And then she took the bottle away. And she said, "We can't drink anymore because I don't want my mom to know that there's any gone." And I was super pissed. And I didn't know why. And so I was like, "Why are you taking this away from me? Like, we just started." I didn't even get drunk. And so I didn't get drunk again for 2 more years. And so that time, I had a 20-ounce bottle filled with, like, vodka, rum, and gin, and nothing else. And it tasted like shit. And so I took a swig of it, and I kind of did the, you know. And I thought, "That tastes really bad," and I slammed the entire bottle. And so what I didn't realize is that I have this phenomenon of craving, okay? And the craving is what happens to me physically. It's after the alcohol has already entered my system. So it's not when I'm thinking about it. So, you know, like sometimes I crave Reese's. Like right now I could be thinking about Reese's. I'm like, "Man, I'm craving that. I want to get one." With alcoholism, it's different. That would be the obsession. So when I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking, and then I'm obsessing about it. And so after I chugged that 20-ounce bottle full of liquor, I was like, "Yep, this is going to be my life. This is my solution," right? Because before I ever even started drinking, I was hospitalized, right? And people thought I was mentally ill. And I couldn't, I was maladjusted to life, let's say that. And so I found alcohol, and I was like, "Great, this is awesome. I've got something I can do." And so for the next 10 years, that was literally the main focus of everything. I wasn't going to hang out anywhere where people weren't drinking. I wasn't going to date somebody that couldn't buy me alcohol, right? Or at least had a friend that could buy us alcohol. And that's what I did. And so it's really fun. Like, drinking was super fun, right? Like, I don't know. Did anybody here have fun while they were drinking? Yeah. So it's pretty sweet at first, right? And I just thought, well, you know, the thing I'm going to do for the rest of my life is I'm going to drink. And I'm going to get a job that allows me to have enough money to live in a mansion so that I can have enough alcohol and have parties all the time, but be a social worker. And so I thought I could make this happen. So anyway, so I get to college, and I'm continuing to drink, and I'm continuing to drink. And life is, it's not super great. I'm starting to yell at people, and I'm starting to tell people in my life why they suck and why they're my problem. And I would drink until 6 o'clock in the morning, and this is so funny. I would blame everybody else, and I'd be sitting there drinking at you. I'm like, "You're the reason that my life sucks. If you knew what I had to deal with when I grew up, you would drink too." And so it gets to this point where I'm living in, like, straight-up filth, and I don't shower a lot. I definitely don't wash my hair but once a month or every couple months. And the room that I live in is covered in filth. The sink, I had one sink in there, and I used to pee and throw up in that sink, right, and then brush my teeth above it, and then shake off my mascara in it. So it's just covered in, like, hair and mascara and God knows what else, and I never cleaned it. And to me, this is fine. I had this big bag of garbage in the room and a big bag of pop cans because I was planning on taking these pop cans back to get money for them. I couldn't do it, though. Like, then the garbage is in the pop can bag, and pop cans are in the garbage bag, and it's not a good thing. And so I'm literally living in filth. And I have this fan that I knocked over one night when I was drunk, like a tall stand-up fan. And so it was like half broken, and it would like shake on the floor, and I just turned that on, and I used that forever. You know, like my stuff, I couldn't hang on to anything. And for a while, I was homeless, but I didn't realize I was homeless because I would just crash at people's couches thinking that that was okay, but it wasn't my home, you know. But I figured I'm not homeless because I'm staying inside somewhere with a suitcase that's busted out and it's ripped and I've got, you know what I mean, that all everything I have is in that suitcase. And that's how I live, and I think that that's totally fine, right? And I don't see anything wrong with that. Like, this is my life. And so I decided I'm going to move in with my brother for a little while, and the whole point was to save up money. And so I think I lived there 9 months, and I spent all of my money on alcohol, cigarettes, and potatoes. So, because I couldn't afford food, you know? That was, buy a big bag of potatoes, microwave one a day, eat that, and have enough to drink. That's where all my money went. And so I'm in college for a little while, and I had this class at 1 o'clock that I was supposed to go to. And so I went one day, and the professor was like, do you want to withdraw from this class? And I was like, well, why would I do that? Like, I feel like I'm doing really well. Like, I'm really smart. I'm a genius, especially when I drink. And she's like, you haven't been here in a month. And that was not my experience. So that was not my perception, for sure. And so it still just wasn't enough. And so I get to this point to where I decide I'm going to clean my system out before homecoming. I was like, I'm going to stay sober for like 4 or 5 days just so I can get really good and drunk because I want to get super wasted for homecoming. And the second day without alcohol, I started going through DTs. I was like, well, that's weird. Okay, so I guess I can't drink for 3 weeks, and then I'll prove to myself I'm not an alcoholic. And that was really tough because I couldn't stay sober in that 3 weeks. I didn't drink, but I tried to do some other stuff. And so I'm trying all this other stuff, and it's not cutting it. And after 3 weeks of really not being sober, but not being on any alcohol or anything, I was like, okay, I'm not an alcoholic because I went 3 weeks without drinking, so I'm going to drink again. And I had these friends that were there really concerned about me, and they said, you should really go get a substance abuse evaluation. So I went to this treatment center, and they did an eval, and they said, you really need to come in for 28 days. I was like, I do not have time for that. That is not going to happen. And so then that was it. And so, but I knew at this point that I really had a hard time drinking, and so, but I didn't really want to stop. And so I met this guy, and we go out on a date, and we go to this restaurant, and we each have 3 drinks and food. And when we're leaving, I'm like, hey, can you stop by the liquor store real quick? And he said, well, why? And I'm like, don't fucking question me. Go to the liquor store. And he was, you know, pretty astounded. But I'm like, you know, I want to drink more than I want to be with you. So he took me to the liquor store, you know. But needless to say, I just would have gone by myself if he hadn't. And so it was funny because that first night he was like, I was like, so I just should tell you, like, I'm a drunk. And he's like, yeah, I used to be a cokehead. I'm like, we are perfect for each other. This is going to work really well. Needless to say, that relationship crashed and burned. There was a point where I was trying to use other substances to not be an alcoholic and to control my drinking. And it didn't work. And I put those substances down, no problem, because they did not do for me what alcohol did for me. You know, there's this effect, this phenomenon of craving, this allergy, right, that happens. It doesn't happen in everybody. And an allergy is just an abnormal reaction, right? It doesn't mean that, like, when I drink, I'm going to break out in hives like when I take penicillin and have to be rushed to the hospital. Well, I mean, sometimes I can be rushed to the hospital, but not because of breaking out in hives and my tongue swelling. It's because I react abnormally. The craving starts once the alcohol is in my system. And if anybody gets in my way, it's not going to be good. And so I cause a lot of chaos in my life. So that one guy I was telling you about with the Coke situation, it got to the point where I'm really trying to control him, right? So I decide I want to break up with him so I can go date some other people to prove to myself how awesome I am because I can get all these dudes, right? And then I find out that, oh, guess what, I'm still alone. And I'm like, I got to get this guy back. Well, that's because he started dating another lady. I was like, oh, hell no, I've got to date him to prove that I'm better than her, right? So she knows. And so I manipulated this guy into breaking up with her, going back out with me, and I didn't even want to be with him, all as a power trip. Right? I'm assuming you can relate because I hear laughing. So like people know what I'm talking about. You know, so I'm ruining people. Like I am manipulating people for this huge ego trip that I have in my head. I didn't want to be with him, and I forced him to move away from another town to be with me. Right? He even changed his major because I convinced him his major sucked. You know? And I think he's still the problem. And I was devoid of all spirituality at this point. He told me one day how he believed in karma. And I said, karma's a bunch of shit. Don't ever talk to me about that again. That's not real. You know, this stuff is not real. The last time I can remember believing in God, I was probably 13 or 14 years old. And it was all, I only prayed when I was scared, like if a tornado was coming or something. Or I'd be like, hey, please let my mom have me stay at this friend's house this weekend. You know, those kind of prayers. So my ego was so inflated as a kid, and then when I grew up, it never really deflated, right? It's a little overactive. So I'm doing this kind of, I have this friend, and she's a really good friend of mine in college, and she did a lot of stuff for me, and we hung out a lot. I don't really know why she even hung out with me. I wasn't very nice to her. I berated her a lot. I talked a lot of shit about her, and she dated this guy for a little bit, and this guy was like, do you realize that Bree treats you really badly, and like she calls you names and all this stuff? All because I was trying to feel better about myself. And so when he pointed that out, I was like, I got to get her to break up with him. This is not going to be good. And I did. And it happened. And I convinced her. And unfortunately, that's an amends today that she still doesn't want to talk to me. You know, and I have to respect that. And so I'm causing all these bad things happen. And you know, I wake up a lot of mornings and, you know, in that bitter morass of self-pity, right? And that hopelessness of, oh my God, what happened last night? I would wake up and my face would be swollen. I'm like, what happened? I'm like, oh, you told so-and-so to slap you last night. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I'd be covered in bruises, puke, right? Usually what would happen is I'd crash at a lot of people's houses, and I would only stay at someone's house because they live close to the bar. And so I had a few people that I would call on when I would come into town. I got sober in Cedar Falls, and where I did most of my drinking. So I would say, all right, I'm coming to town this weekend. Let me stay at your house just so I had somewhere to stay. And every time I'd wake up, all their stuff in their room would be, like, knocked over. Right? Like, there's this path of destruction for me walking in. Like, the nightstands tipped over, the lamps on the floor, everything that was on top of the dresser is off. There's just this wreckage, physical wreckage from where I've been. And so I'm just like, damn, that sucks, you know, and I'm covered in puke, and I smell like puke, and I'm glad that I was a puker. I feel a little dignified about that. I moved out to Wyoming, and a lot of people there talk about peeing themselves, and I'm just like, oh, I was a puker, so that makes me so, you know, a little bit more dignified. And so throw up and drink more. And there was one night I went to this party, And I woke up the next day, and my friend was like, dude, Bree, do you remember what happened last night? And I was like, no. You know, of course not. So she proceeds to tell me this story. And she's like, this dude, so I went into this room to pass out, and this dude follows me in there, right? And then my other friend was like, where's that creepy dude that was following Bree around? Right? And he got in there just in time, right? He comes in, and this dude is on top of me, straddling me with his, like, camera phone out. And so he goes back to punch the guy, my friend. So then my other friend comes in, the girl, and she's like, oh, my God, and they kick him out. Literally just in time. Like, God's will just happened to work out really well that night, you know? And so when she tells me about this the next day, the weirdest thing was I was numb to it. This was not a good enough reason for me to stop drinking. Alcoholic torture shows up differently for a lot of us, and that was one way it showed up for me. And she's telling me this, that could have been a very bad situation. And all I can think is, I need to drink more. I don't even want to face that stuff. Like, that's the weirdest feeling. And after I was sober about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, I remember the rest of what happened that night, and I'm running around the party trying to get a bunch of dudes to make out with me, right? And who? Gross. Sloppy, hot mess. And then the one guy finally does, And then, and he starts beating me up, right? But here's the thing. I'm so drunk. I can't defend myself. I can't do anything. My behavior before that was freaking terrible. And I'm not saying that I deserve that. That is not what that means at all. But I really need to take a look at what the hell I'm doing, right? And I'm running around being unprincipled and trying to do some nasty stuff. So, you know, and it was the weirdest thing. And I remember when I finally escaped and I was crawling up the stairs and he grabbed me. Somebody opened the basement door and he pulled back. And so even if that night would have turned out differently, God still would have been there because God's always there, right? It doesn't matter if something ends up positive or negative, right? But it's how am I going to rely on the Spirit after something like that? You know what I mean? And I blocked that stuff out. And so this is, you know, alcoholic torture. Stuff like this happens. I still don't think I need to quit. This is a normal nightly occurrence for somebody like me to get into this kind of trouble, you know? And that's going to look different for everybody. See, I never got arrested, right? And because that's not what makes me an alcoholic. You know, not all those outside circumstances. It's the fact that once I start drinking, I can't stop. And when I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. You know, I don't have any triggers. Being sober is what makes me want to drink. Just waking up, right? And I'm sober. I need to drink. And so, you know, this is my life. And it gets to this point where I realize I might need to change. And that sucks. I don't want to change. So I decide that I'm going to get sober. And I stay sober about 5 months on my own. And I was very cocky. I'm like, see, that wasn't so hard, right? People who drink are just stupid. I'm awesome. And then it wasn't so easy anymore. You know, I'm sober, and sober with no God and no alcohol is pretty rough. And so this guy I was dating, I think he just wanted me to drink again, you know, because I'm still manipulating, right? And I'm still doing all this awful stuff. And he says, you know, I work with this guy who's an AA. I'd like to introduce you to him. And I said, okay. So we go to his house one night, and we meet this guy and his wife, and this guy says to me, he's talking about the big book and stuff for a while, and he said, the one thing I remember he said is God, who wrote the book through Bill W. And I said, this dude is crazy. I'm not that. We're done here. Right, we're done here. And I was like, I'll still go to some meetings, right, and just kind of see what it's about, because obviously I can't do this on my own. I tried to go to counseling, and they said, we can't help you. And I was like, oh, that's fun. So I go to some of these meetings, and I went to one meeting, and they talk a lot about God and the seven step, and I was like, I don't know what the hell this is about. It's creeping me out. And I go to one meeting, and somebody starts talking about meth, and I'm like, I don't belong here. They're talking about meth. I'm not a meth head. Sweet. And so I quit going, and I decided that I was going to stay sober by crocheting and watching Buffy. And did not work. So my obsession came back hardcore. And I was in this internship, and a lot of the people that I worked with there, they would like go home and like smoke a joint and have a glass of wine every night. And I'd be like, well, why can't I do that? See, when I stopped that time, I knew that once I started drinking, I couldn't stop. So I had self-knowledge. And so I figured self-knowledge would keep me sober. And it did not. Because that obsession kicked in hardcore. And that is baffling. And I can't tell you how many times when I said to myself, man, I'm never going to drink again. And then later that night, I'm drinking and I go, oh, I changed my mind. I just changed my mind, right? No big deal. I wasn't lying when I said I was never going to drink again. I meant that shit, you know? So why can't I stop? I've lost the power of choice. So I'm trying to get sober, right, watching Buffy, and it's not working, and things suck, and I'm pretty angry all the time, and I'm yelling at people, and I'm just an asshole, and I'm just not a good person to be around. I'm like, you know what? I think I'm just going to drink again. It's going to be fine, right, because I'm going to control it. I'm going to limit this. And so, right. And so I decided that I was going to have 2 glasses of wine once a week. And so I poured an entire bottle of wine into one glass, an entire bottle of wine in the other glass, and that was my 2 glasses of wine. And it still wasn't enough. right? But I'm like, and I used to have this big giant, like, I called it my Cavarsier glass, and it was like a big fishbowl on a stem. And I would just, like, just keep pouring wine in there all night, right? Because I, you know, if I switched from vodka to wine, I wasn't an alcoholic. And so, because wine is natural and it's somewhat classy, even if it's in a box. And so, you know, and that's what I would do. And so just pour, you know, fill that glass up. And so I really kind of liked that, you know. And I thought, I'm going to change my rule here. I'm going to drink maybe just on the weekends, maybe two or three nights. And as long as I'm not drinking vodka, it's okay, right, or liquor. And then I'm breaking that rule. And then I'm like, okay, as long as I don't go to the bars, I'm not an alcoholic. And then I'm at the bar, and I'm like, well, as long as I don't take shots, then I'm taking shots, right? And I'm like, oh, God, well, I guess as long as I don't crash at random people's houses and I wake up in a freaking frat house one morning, which is not typical for somebody like me, I'd rather wake up, like, after a metal show, right? So that was awkward. And so, not what you said, the frat house thing. And so what happens is I woke up there, when I woke up that morning, though, that behavior was objectionable to me. And it never used to be. And so I'm like, man, but it's fine. I'm just going to power through this. Right? It's going to be fine. And I wake up one morning in my living room, like, not quite, like, halfway undressed, trying to get my pajamas on, a half-eaten McChicken on my chest, right? And I'm like, fuck. You know, here we are again. Okay, whatever, it's fine. And so the last night I drank, some people have really profound stories of the last nights that they drank, and mine really wasn't that profound. A friend of mine was having a birthday, and I just went to her house and got drunk. And what happened was the next morning when I woke up, and I'm sleeping next to this dude that I don't love, who I live with. And and what happened was, I had almost 10 months of sobriety before I went out in this relapse. And I wake up and I'm like, oh my God, this sucks. Like, I had almost a year of sobriety and I gave it up for what? To be just as shitty as I was before, doing the same unprincipled behavior and to be in this god-awful relationship. Nothing's changed. This sucks. And I wanted to be sober, but I didn't know how. And I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. It was really hard. And that's hopelessness, right? I can't imagine living with or without it. And so I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so at this point, I was pretty much willing to do whatever because I had tried a lot of different things to stay sober. And they read out of More About Alcoholism, Here Are the Methods We Have Tried. I believe it's page 31. And so it's like taking a trip, not taking a trip, drinking, what, brandy or drinking only natural wines, right? I'm like, yeah, I've done all that stuff, right? Changed boyfriends, changed towns, changed my liquor, everything. And so when they read that, I was like, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, sweet. Okay, good. So something's working because these people are all here, right? They seem to be doing well. And it was really nice to know that there was something that could help me. And so they talked about these steps, right? And so I was like, all right, I got to do them right now. Let's go. Because everybody was talking about it. And I'm like, I'm going to do what I have to do. I don't want to live like this anymore. So I did steps 4, 5, 8, 9, and 12. And worked well enough for me, I guess. And so that first inventory was fantastic. Because I was finally honest about my intentions. It's finally honest about who I was, right? Self-manifests in all these different ways, and I'm finally seeing it for the first time. And so that was pretty intense. So then I become Little Miss AA, right? And so my second meeting I ever went to was at a treatment center. And I didn't realize what 12-step work was at that time, but I just knew that I liked going to the treatment center, and I felt really good when I left, you know? And so I went to that meeting every week. And then I got a home group, and this home group met on Saturday mornings, and we all went to the treatment center together every week. And they even went to the jail, and I couldn't go in the jail yet because I hadn't had a year sober, but, like, my home group members were doing stuff together, and it was fun. And I go to potlucks, right, and parties and picnics and dances and all this stuff, and I'm Little Miss AA, and then I find myself a Mr. AA, you know, and everything's going to be great. And, It was great until it wasn't. And so at about a year sober, I moved to Pella, Iowa. Is anybody familiar with Pella? Tulip, yes. Yes, tulips. Yep. So what happened was, though, is all the people that I had in AA weren't there. And so, and I had no God in my life. And that was tough. And all of a sudden, all that social shit wasn't so fun anymore. And I didn't like the people that were there. And I missed my AA group back in Cedar Falls, and I was not okay. And I was crying every day and starting to get panic attacks again, and I was depressed. And I have this thing where when I cry, I like to go in the bathroom to cry, so I run to the bathroom and I cry. You know, that's my thing. I still do that today. I'd like to go to the bathroom to cry. I can't explain it. So, and that's what I did. And it sucked. And I had no idea what was going on. And so we started listening to these speakers, Katie and Charlie from Texas. And they came up to Iowa, and they spoke in Cedar Rapids. And they start talking about, this isn't about not drinking anymore. I'm like, what? I'm like, yeah. The problem is you're selfish and self-centered, driven by 100 forms of fear. Self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. That's what my problem is. Oh, damn it. So what do I do? I didn't like the answer. And so my husband, that boyfriend at the time, asked this guy to sponsor him, who's actually going to be speaking here on Sunday. So he asked this guy to sponsor him, and I thought, well, he cannot be better at AA than me. So I've got to ask that guy's wife. And so I said, will you take me through the book, you know, line by line? Because I had only went through in, you know, pieces, like I told you before. Step 4, 5, 8, 9. And my first 4-step, by the way, I didn't even do fear or conduct. It was just resentment because I didn't bother reading the book. So, so I asked her to take me through the book. And what she says to me is, the purpose of this book is to get you connected with God. Huh. How come nobody told me that? Well, they might have, but I wasn't going to listen, because any time somebody talked about God that first year I was sober, I made fun of them in meetings. I made sure to make a point of that and laugh at them. Well, I thought they were stupid. And she says this to me, the purpose of this book is to get you connected with God. That is the solution that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. Oh, okay. Well, I'm not really a big fan of that, but everything else I've tried isn't working, and I'm super depressed, and I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism, and I'm going to die. So I guess I'll do it. Yeah, why not, you know? And so that social stuff really almost killed me. You know, I was super busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm doing all this random shit, and I don't have a God in my life. I'm not sponsoring anyone. And yet, and I think that's what it is, and that shit almost killed me. And so I decided to go through the book with her, and I'm learning a lot about this, and it was awesome. And what I found out from the biggest message that I remember from her, which is really funny, is like, this shit's going to kill you, even sober. Oh, my God, because I was suffering from untreated alcoholism. Wow, like that one time I tried to get sober and not go to AA, and then I get sober and I'm still not finding a God in my life. Okay, I get this. And so there's a couple times since then that these things were brought to my attention in sobriety that I didn't want to do. And I thought, if this is God's will for me, I can't have a God in my life. It's not going to happen. And there was something, I thought I was getting these signs to change something about myself that I didn't really want to change. And so I'm really upset about it. And it has to do with this like procedure to try to not be blind anymore. And I'm like, I'm not doing that shit. And this lady, she says to me, she's like, well, Bree, you need to do it if it's going to make you more useful. And I'm like, you need to fuck off. So I didn't talk to her again. Pardon my language. I'm really sorry. There's probably children somewhere, right? I heard a baby earlier. So, sorry. Sorry, parents. So, because they will totally remember this. So she says that to me, and I'm freaking out. I'm like, man, I can't do this. Like, I can't do this God thing. And I'm talking to all these different people. I'm calling all these mentors. And I'm like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And finally, my husband says to me, he's like, Bree, I feel like if it was really, like, your spiritual intuition to do that, it wouldn't hurt so much. Like, it wouldn't be such a big deal. And I was like, oh, nice. Right, because I did not feel like it's what I was meant to do. So I have all these situations, right, that I have to start to seek God and not my sponsor. My sponsor tells me what to do. Mm-mm. Nope. So this lady that was taking me through the book, she never told me what to do, because this is a process where we walk together hand in hand, shoulder to shoulder. There's none of this ego bullshit. There's none of this, I'm going to tell you how to run your life. That's not a thing. Thank God, because like I said, when somebody tells me what to do, nah, we're done. And that was, I'm so glad that she sponsored like that. And so then there's this other lady I've been working with recently, and I was telling her I kind of want to change jobs because I don't like my job, right? Because I'm an alcoholic and I'm just never satisfied. So my solution is to get a new job, right, get a new house, whatever, instead of rely on God. And she's like, Bree, I'm going to have to chastise you if you look for a new job. And I'm like, I don't think so. I think that's none of your damn business. You do not get to chastise me. Because I make a decision in my life, whether it's God or it's ego, whatever decision I make, it's not going to be irrevocable, right? Even if I don't follow the intuition, I will learn from making the decision whether that was intuition or not. And so I'm just not a big fan of being told what to do, and I'm not going to tell my sponsees what to do. I'm like, call me when you want to call me and we'll talk, right? I'm going to take you through this process. I'm not going to tell you to call me every day. And you don't even have to call me at a certain time. If you want to make a schedule because it's easier for you, that's fine. Like, I will make time. I'm never going to tell anybody no. You know, Rick Carter. Oh, damn it. Rick. My bad. He says this thing about, he said this thing about sponsoring people that I appreciated. And I'm going to see if I remember this right. But if somebody asks him to sponsor him, he says, all right, there's three different ways we can do this. One, you can just call me your sponsor. I don't care. Tell everybody that. It's fine with me. Two, I can just take you through the steps. Or three, I'll take you through all three legacies, and we can do this process together and become full-fledged members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was like, ooh, I want option three. You know, and so I've started giving those options to the people that asked to work with me. I'm like, here's, you know, whatever works is fine for me. Because you need a God in your life. I need a God in my life. How many times have I needed to talk to somebody and my sponsor is not available to answer the phone? I better have a God. Right? And so I have all these things that I have to deal with that are really hard, like, you know, just being comfortable in my own skin. The first time in sobriety that I went out in public without makeup on, I almost cried. It was terrible because that's how much I didn't like myself. And then I prayed about that every day for months, and all of a sudden it was fine. And then it's just going to morph into something else later. My ego is going to trip me up. That's what it does. And it's going to start telling me, oh, you're really not that smart, so I'm going to use that to get at you. And then I'll pray, and I'll work through that, hopefully do 10 and 11, right? And so throughout this process, I was able to get involved in general service in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to my first area assembly for Iowa, Area 24, when I was 8 months sober. And when I walked into that conference room that weekend, what I saw was a lot of people giving up their free time for Alcoholics Anonymous for free. And I was pretty impressed with that. I was like, all right, I could do this. You know, I could do this. And it's been quite an intense journey for me. I've continued to stay in the service structure. I continue to do 12-step work, right? And so the thing is service work is not 12-step work. But 12-step work is a form of service work. Does that make sense? So, like, obviously, I'm not going to give anybody rides to meetings, but let's say I could give a bunch of rides. Okay? That's not 12-step work. That's service work. But if you happen to 12-step somebody in the car, then, hey, yeah, cool. That could probably be 12-step work, right? Making coffee, that's service work. That's not 12-step work. Right? And so one of the things that's been really influential for me is really diving into the traditions and the concepts. The concepts are really hard. I used to go to Jordan's house every Wednesday and study them and fall asleep. And I don't do that anymore, but I did, and it was hard. And so the traditions are here to protect you from me and vice versa. And so what's really awesome is I have this super cool home group now, and I didn't have an awesome home group when I lived in District 12 in Pella. We tried really hard to make a home group, and it was tough being homeless and jobless in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I wasn't jobless. I decided to take on 3 service positions at once. Didn't do me any damn good. I did a really bad job at all those positions because I couldn't just pick one. Yeah, that was not very good. And I learned that now, but it was all ego for me. I'm like, I am the PICPC chair, I am the treatment accessibilities chair, I am the workshop chair, and I'm a GSR. I'm pretty important. Right? I'm pretty important. Yeah, didn't work out too well. I learned very quickly from that. I also thought by being a GSR, I could change my home group right away. And so I decided to become a GSR in this town in Pella, and I was like, all right, I'm going to change everything that they do. They did not like that. It did not work. And I forgot that I was there to serve them, right? And so when my term was up, my 2 years was done, I was like, well, you guys, my term's almost up, so if you want a new GSR, you're going to have elections. They're like, oh, we'll just have you do it again. I said, no way. Spirit of rotation. I'm not doing that again. I need to give somebody else a shot, right? And so I'm going to area, and I get really passionate about some certain things, and I'm doing all this stuff. And I decide that accessibility is a big thing for me. And so I'm always at area assemblies and regional events yelling about, you need accessible literature. We need accessible literature. Some people may get tired of it, and I really don't care. I'm not going to stop. And so it's really important to me to have our basic literature available in any format, right? All the accessible formats. I would hate to have somebody walk in Alcoholics Anonymous and not be able to access our message, which is in the book. And so that's kind of one of the things that I decided to take on. Like, oh, this is my thing in AA. This is what I'm going to do, right? Once again, I still kind of get to be little Miss AA with that. And so moving to Casper has been pretty awesome because I've really learned about what it means to have a home group and what that looks like. And so in my home group, we have about 8 home group members. And we have regular business meetings. And we hang out before and after the meeting. It's at 10 o'clock, so sometimes we might hang out till midnight, 1, 2 in the morning. And we don't plan social events. We don't go bowling. We don't have parties. What happened is that fellowship arose out of us having a strong home group and trying to live a principled life. We really try to understand the principles. And so we have a study group every week that meets on Wednesday. And we'll do one step and talk about it till we're done. Then we'll talk about the tradition. Then we'll talk about the concept. I think we just did step 5 on Wednesday. We may or may not talk about it again next Wednesday. I'd like to move on to tradition 5. I feel like we're done with it, but it's a group thing, right? It's not my decision. And so we do this and we study and we become really close and we're close knit. And the thing is, we do 12-step work together, right? And so that hospital situation I was telling you about. We are lucky enough to get a relationship with the hospital, and now we have a Google Voice number, and they call us when they've got a drunk that's willing to talk. And that, to me, is fantastic. Straight to the source, right when they're jittery, before their minds have gotten clogged up with all this crap. We can get them right then. And so then hopefully the hospital will continue to trust us and like us, and we'll build up that relationship because it's the group's responsibility to do the 12-step work and to do the CPC work and the public information work. It's not the district's responsibility, and it's not GSO's responsibility or area's responsibility. It's ours. We have the power. We are supposed to tell them what to do. And that is pretty cool. It's not how I always see it happening. Right, but that's kind of what we've started to form in my home group. And so then we've got this Google Voice number, and we can hand that out, and people can just call us. They don't have to call, a district hotline and not talk to an alcoholic because somebody else is answering. You know, they get to go straight to the source. And that's pretty sweet. And so we don't currently have a GSR. We're hoping that this new person that joined will become a GSR. I think it'd be pretty sweet. Either way, it doesn't matter. But I have had the opportunity to serve for the last year as an appointed committee member on the Trustees Committee for Treatment Accessibilities and CPC. And so 4 times a year this last year, I've got to travel to New York and go to the board meetings, right? And I got to be at the beginning of the General Service Conference And what I'm supposed to be doing is helping change the language and the literature for accessibility to make it, because we changed the name of the committee from special needs to accessibility. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? Awesome. Okay, sweet. And so I talked about that a lot too before that changed. And so what was funny is I get on this committee and I go to my first weekend in New York last July, and there's trustees and board members there. And I mean, these are like the top dogs of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Well, they're the lower part of the service structure, which I forget. But I think I'm somebody when I get there. I'm like, oh, I have arrived, like Bill was talking about. You know, like this is it. But prestige and power and money are going to kill me faster than anything else. And I'm glad I learned that real quick right after I got home. And what happened was I show up there, and they have like these dinners for us. Like they do lunch for us on Saturday. We have a dinner and an AA meeting. I use quotes because I'm not really sure if it's an AA meeting on Saturday night. And they have all this really fancy food, right? And so they have like glass bottles of pop sitting out for us. And like the fancy, like, I don't know, like trout and a bunch of random stuff, like stuff I don't really want to eat even, but it's like, it's expensive food, all right? And these are your contributions, okay? I want you to remember that. And so I show up and I'm like, can we be a little bit more prudent? I mean, we don't have to eat the fanciest thing, you know what I mean? And so all this money, I mean, they have trustees dinners where they spend thousands of dollars, you know? And so this is the stuff I want to, you know, let my group know about. And so they have work for me to do. And I was able to sit on the subcommittee for cooperation with the professional communities for LinkedIn, okay? And so in that committee, what we were supposed to do was explore the possible uses of LinkedIn for GSO and if we should have a LinkedIn page or not. I was the only person on the committee that did not think that was a good idea. So I was a minority opinion. What we were supposed to do is talk about traditions. Now, if I'm looking at the traditions, I'm looking at these spiritual principles, and if we all are studying them, then most likely we're going to agree because it's pretty black and white. But that was not the case. We didn't even really look at the traditions. There wasn't even a lot of conversation about that. And the lower part of the service structure, they're supposed to be the stewards and the guardians of our principles. You know what I'm saying? But, I mean, I really have enjoyed this opportunity, and it's been super awesome. But the one thing we have to remember is that the groups are supposed to have control here. So in my home group, we don't pass the basket because the tradition specifically states by the voluntary contributions of its own members, each group's own members. So only home group members contribute. And we explain that, right? Because we don't need a lot of money. It does not take a lot of money to do 12-step work. You know what I'm saying? And so sometimes people, they don't like that. They want to give, right, because they love AA. And they're like, what? Take my money. Take it. And we try to explain. And if somebody's really forceful, we might take it. And sometimes I'm like, I'm just going to throw it in the trash. We don't need it. It is not a good thing to be rich in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't need money, that much money, to do 12-step work. And so there's a lot of things happening right now. Has anybody read, did anybody read and study up on the agenda items before the conference in April? Yes. Fantastic. So that's what I like to hear. So there's a lot of stuff that's going on that we really need to be paying attention to. And especially as age has nothing to do with it. But this generation of Alcoholics Anonymous, like, I feel like this is my responsibility to pay attention to this stuff and guard these principles, right, and to continue to stand up. And people aren't always going to like that, but that's not my problem. Because as long as I have God on my side and I'm doing what God wants me to do and I'm trying to be kind, then I don't have to apologize for anything. The principles do not need to be apologized for. And so this is the kind of stuff that I've been kind of dealing with in the last couple of years, is what I've already accepted that AA could possibly turn into something that's totally unrecognizable. And I have to be okay with that. No matter what happens, I have to be fine. If my husband dies tomorrow, I have to be fine because I have a God. Like, I have to be okay no matter what. But I also know that I have to at least try my best, right? And you know, Bill says, the good is the enemy of the best, right? Well, I'm really bad at doing the best. I'm lucky if I can get halfway to good sometimes, right? But it's about taking that effort to study and to understand and to be informed. The nice thing is I can say about my home group is that we're really informed in our group conscience. You know, if we just show up and we want to do a bunch of random stuff and make decisions about something we know nothing about, well, I mean, that's fine. You have the right to do that. You know, but we also don't run around to other groups in town and go in there and say, tell them how we think they need to be doing things. There's no room for that either. So I don't travel to a lot of meetings every week. My days are filled. I've got my meetings for my home group. I don't travel to a lot of other places. And I meet with my sponsees. I do a concept study call, right? And I do 12-step work. And that's what takes up my time. And that's what saved my ass. Because it says in the big book, right? When all else fails, work with another alcoholic will save the day. And so it's really important for people that are involved in the service structure to be involved in 12-step work. Because for me to be just an activity addict or to be a service junkie isn't going to do any good either. Because then I forget why we're here. You know, why are we here? You know, so I really hope that people that are in the service structure are doing regular 12-step work. If somebody says to me, this job that I take in AA as a secretary or a treasurer, as a delegate, is going to be the most important thing I ever do, I say, well, then I don't want you to serve for me. Because the most important thing that you should ever do should be working with other drunks. That was really rude how I said you should. But this has been my experience. It's the one thing that saved my ass. And so I didn't bring my watch. I don't know what time it is. I feel like it's been long enough. What time did I start? I feel like the channel has pretty much stopped. I feel like we're good. So thank you for allowing me to be here, and have a nice weekend.
Yay.